Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we turn to a topic on the minds of many Mainers. How do schools in rural areas serve the people who live there? And how can they meet the needs of their communities now and in the future? Speaking at UMaine Orono, Interim Dean Zeke Kimball and Associate Professor Kat Biddle discuss how schools are the lifeblood of communities, and how families and educators in rural places are confronting the challenges of today and preparing for the opportunities of tomorrow. This talk was recorded on November 25th, 2024, at a live event hosted by UMaine's Mitchell Center. Professor Kimball kicks the conversation off with a big question: what exactly is the public good?
When we talk about a public good, we talk about it as though we know what that means. But I think it makes sense to take a moment or two to stop and ask the question, what are we actually talking about? When economists and public policy researchers think about public goods, they generally describe it as one that can't be provided privately. So for example, fire protection services or national defense. Neither really makes sense as private goods. And they further argue that public goods are one where one person's use of that good does not typically make it impossible for someone else to enjoy that same good. So here, for example, we're thinking about things like scenic overlooks, right? When we founded the national park system in the United States, it was in part predicated on the assumption that the natural environment is a public good. Now, educational scholars love to complicate things. We spend a lot of time troubling consensus. And so when we talk about public good, we often add a third caveat, which is that a public good is a good in the public's interest. So what do we mean by that? Think for a moment about a well-educated citizenry. We're talking about a group of people that's not only prepared for the workforce, for their own career development, they're also prepared to engage in a democratic society in highly productive and meaningful ways. That's something that benefits not just the individual, but the collective. And indeed, given the importance of being able to engage in those sorts of ways, there's a really strong argument to be made that it matters more for the collective than it does for the individual. Within that framework, I'd like to ask you to take a moment to think about the University of Maine and where the University of Maine is situated in the history of higher education. And I apologize, I was trained as a historian of higher education, so anytime someone lets me loose near a microphone, I end up talking about it just for a moment, but I promise this will make sense in a second. So the University of Maine was founded in response to the Morrill Land Grant Act of 1862. And by design, the University of Maine has always offered a practical education in the service of the state of Maine. When the namesake of the Land Grant Act was asked to describe its purpose, Senator Justin Morrill of Vermont framed the philosophy as follows: to be accessible to all, but especially to the sons of toil. Now, gendered language aside, this idea is exceptionally important in the history of access to higher education. Until the Morrill Land Grant Act, higher education largely educated students that came from backgrounds of considerable privilege. Higher education didn't create opportunity. It merely solidified the opportunities that already existed to those who attended it. The Morrill Land Grant Act introduces a distinctly new tradition of access in the history of higher education. Until the Morrill Land Grant Act, higher education institutions generally forsook utility in order to ensure that college graduates had acquired the sort of higher learning generally associated with college. The Yale Report of 1828, for example, argues that the purpose of higher education is not to prepare a student for a career or to solve problems. It's to provide the discipline and furniture of the mind that allows a person to demonstrate their education. I promise I'm getting to a point. I believe in the intrinsic good of education as much as any person that I know, but defining the goal of education as being able to demonstrate that you are educated makes little sense in the reality of the world. Just as we do today, people in the first half of the 19th century grappled with fundamental questions about health and economy, the natural world, and the nature of scientific progress and who would benefit from it. a higher education that had the capacity to be of use and chose not to, that's a particularly interesting formulation, and certainly not one in the public good. But the Morrill Land Grant Act aimed to change that, and not in a small way, but in a sweepingly dramatic one. Rather than offer training in the classical humanities, colleges founded in response to the Morrill Land Grant Act taught the practical arts, including engineering and agriculture. They taught in a language accessible to the students that attended, which doesn't seem like it should be a weird idea, but turns out it was in the 19th century. And they aimed to take what happened in classrooms and apply it in the real world. That commitment was further solidified by the Hatch Act of 1887 that provided funding for agricultural field experiment stations like the one we have on this campus to this day, and the Smith-Lever Act of 1914 that funded cooperative extension for the first time in the United States. This legislation, which was clearly rurally inflected, given its focus both on identified needs of rural communities and the insistence that higher educations look beyond the bounds of their campus, made it an explicit responsibility of land-grant institutions to engage in extension, to engage in outreach, and to work in ways that mattered to the communities that they were intended to serve. In the case of the University of Maine, that's the people and places of Maine. Pivoting to the present, we must also understand that education as a public good conveys a sense of goal direction. Education is not a neutral act. It must matter not just in the lives of the collective, in schools, communities, and in the state as a whole, but in the everyday lives of real people. A public good must address individual needs collectively. To understand why that's important, let's think for a moment about what we really mean when we say the opportunities of tomorrow, which is part of our framing for this talk today. Those opportunities will all involve confronting a pressing problem and meeting the moment with the solutions that they require. A rapidly aging population will mean that Maine needs new innovative strategies for healthcare and elder care services. It will mean that we need to design programs, services, and public infrastructure differently to ensure age-friendly, accessible futures. Sea level rise in a warming world will mean that we need new strategies for coastal resilience, and we need new frameworks for thriving rural communities. It will mean that ecological thinking becomes part and parcel of every industry and every civic process, because we'll have no choice. We will also need strategies for the ethical, responsible use of AI as AI algorithms grow in prevalence, but so too does the possibility of unseen biases and discriminatory logics embedded therein. The rise of AI will dramatically increase concerns about data privacy and security, while also transforming workforces in unexpected ways. Finally, the transformation of rural economies will continue as sustainable practices help grow Maine's historic economic drivers, and new innovation economies buttress these rural heritage economies. But changes in rural economies will also strain communities as access gaps related to education, healthcare, and technology will widen without protective action. Now, I'm placing my finger on the scale a bit with this last one, right? So we're talking about rural education and community development. I'm throwing this into the mix. But really, when you think about the other challenges on this list, growing economic inequality, food and housing insecurity, youth disengagement with political processes, these all affect rural communities disparately. And unless we respond in highly intentional ways, we're going to leave people and places behind. The point is, overall, that we don't know exactly what the challenges will be, but we know that they will require us to think in rurally inflected ways. And as we do that, we're going to pursue strategies for innovation that will help us to meet the moment. I want to be upfront. The first and the most important of these is simply hope. Simply having the courage to tackle wicked problems is the first and most vital prerequisite for addressing every challenge that follows. Having that hope requires creating the conditions where young people can learn fundamental skills of resilience and problem solving. But hope alone won't be enough. we need to work at human technology frontiers that will enable the integration of advanced technologies into daily life and work. Principles of convergent science can help us to leverage the best of many academic fields through interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary practices. By shifting the focus of how we create and organize knowledge from disciplines to problems, we can more effectively leverage what we do at places like the University of Maine for the public good and for the good of rural communities. Meanwhile, the data science revolution will allow us to develop data processing models that we never thought technologically possible, and to identify problems and solutions we might never have noticed without the guidance of data analytics, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. But to return to a point that I've already made, if rural people and rural places are not in those conversations from the outset, those very same models that can help us solve problems that matter will ignore the needs of rural people and places. So that's a lot. But I want to tell you that I'm hopeful. Kat and I, we work with young people and the people who work with them each and every day. Those interactions fill me with hope. Hope that their creativity and their evident care for one another, their passion, and their desire to find a way forward in a world that is ever more complicated will be what the moment requires. But I also want to be really honest that these same things give me pause. Pause because this moment is very big and the problems that we confront are very big too. Pause because compared to the size and scope and scale of those problems, human beings individually are quite small. We're not going to be able to tackle these problems individually. We're going to have to address them collectively. And finally, I pause because in moments where we're about to begin a really big conversation, it makes sense to ask the question, who's in the room and who's not? And all too often, as Kat will share in a moment, when we pull that conversation together, the voices that we miss are from rural people and rural places. And unless we include rural people from rural places in these conversations, we won't meet the needs of rural communities.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. That was UMaine's Zeke Kimball, discussing education and the opportunities of tomorrow. Up next, his colleague, Kat Biddle, continues the conversation.
So when I describe what I study to others, I often use the term spatial inequality, meaning the ways in which opportunity and disadvantage are distributed across different places. So in my research, I focus on the extent to which this distribution tends to disadvantage rural places and people and the relationship of education to that inequality. So for example, are schools helping to disrupt those patterns or are they helping to perpetuate it? And if you live in Maine right now, which we all do, I think this is a pretty important concept to understand because 3/4 of Maine school districts are classified as rural. So all of us, whether we live in a rural community or not, are in some ways affected by this distribution of opportunities and challenges. And I also think it's important to acknowledge that in the field of education specifically, we have a long history of thinking of rural schools through a very particular deficit-oriented lens. And to understand this, we have to go back about 100 years to the period between 1910 and 1920. So during this time, as the quote-unquote modern school system was starting to come together, much as it is today, and what I mean by that is multi-grade schools with teachers who specialize in different subjects, who receive specialized training, and administrators who understand organizational theory and instructional supervision and all the things that we talk about. During this moment, education reformers started to turn their attention to the one-room schoolhouses that still existed in rural America, wanting to bring them into the modern school fold. And these reformers saw all kinds of challenges to implementing their modern vision of schooling in rural America. You know, they couldn't attract enough teachers to fill their graded classrooms who wanted to live in rural places. And they couldn't get communities to pay for their modern school buildings. And at that time, electrification and rural infrastructure was uneven, and rural economies were weak, and youth were leaving the countryside to find work in the city. And reformers at that time saw all of this, and they added to the list the backwardness and parochialism and lack of education in rural communities. I say all of that in quotes, right? As an impediment to their modern vision of schooling. So a very deficit-oriented view of rural people, and they coined a term for this. They called it the rural school problem. So this is an example from that time of one of these reformers who said, the challenges of the rural school consist of a lack of carefully trained and experienced teachers, short terms of school, poorly constructed schoolhouses, insufficient equipment, annual or semi-annual change of teachers, enrollment too small for best results, many grades and small classes, limited social opportunities for teachers, inconvenient boarding places, teachers not in touch with the life of the community, and a community not vitally interested in the schools. And when I read this quote to a room full of education researchers, they laugh because this sounds so much like the discourse today. So some people, probably a lot of people here today, actually, might have looked at these challenges and said, you know, maybe we need to design schools that better fit the strengths of these places, rather than trying to fit these communities into our urbanized model of schooling. And there were some people saying that at the time. It isn't as if all of this went down without a robust discussion. When attention to rural education was at its height in the sort of 1910 to 1920 period, there were plenty of rural teacher preparation programs that were designed to encourage people to teach in rural communities. And there were departments of rural education at colleges and universities that were devoted to the study of rural schools. And there was robust debate on the best curriculum for students from rural areas, including many people advocating for curriculum that put children in touch with the places that they lived in meaningful ways and encouraged them to stay in or return to those places. But in the end, as one-room schoolhouses disappeared over the course of the 20th century and reformers felt that they'd solved the rural school problem, the prevailing outcome of modern education reform has been that it's followed the words of Elwood Cubberley, who was one of the prominent reformers at that time, that what is good for the city school should also be good for the rural school. And we see that play out in all kinds of ways that I'm going to talk about in a second. But in the meantime, the circumstances of rural America have changed profoundly since the modern school system was introduced. And Zeke outlined some of the contemporary issues that are shaping what change looks like today and in the years to come. But rural communities have been and continue to grapple with the consolidation of the global economy, shrinking populations as rural people are treated as reserve labor for global capitalism, and the rising and persistent poverty rates that accompany these conditions. So meanwhile, the focus of federal education policy has been less on responsiveness to local imperatives and more towards its implications for global economic success. So these are changes that we aren't just seeing here in the United States, but in nations all over the world. So this shift is sometimes called the global education reform movement, and it's characterized by a couple of things. One is a focus on literacy and numeracy, standardized testing and teaching, prescribed curriculum, market-oriented reforms, and test-based accountability. And this context sets up an almost impossible challenge for rural educational leaders, a situation in which community well-being and the principles of global education reform may feel like they're fighting for a spot as most important. So you've got kids coming to school from families who are economically insecure and face incredible challenges every day. And you've also simultaneously got this push to raise students' performance on standardized tests, to ensure progression in literacy and numeracy. And there are intense pressures that are associated with that performance. Things that include funding and carrots and sticks that are related to opportunities and recognition. So When my team and I talked to 150 educators across Washington County for a project that we did recently, this was one of the quotes that we heard. We're busting our ass with ELA and math. ELA is English Language Arts, and taking every resource we can. But our English Language Arts and our math are not going to increase. We're almost trying to fix the, you say to a mechanic, have the whole car fixed except for the motor in the middle. And we can't. It has to be the whole child. And we can't, with the resources we have, treat the whole child. So one of the things that we found as part of this study was that this situation that our educators in rural communities find themselves in has eroded their sense of what's possible, what rural children deserve. So because when we ask them what they would want if they could wave a magic wand, anything that would help improve education from their perspective, they told us that they would settle for a school counselor one day a week. So one of the ways that I've started to address this sense of powerlessness is by helping communities to think critically about rural school community relationships. And I found that highlighting what I call four stories helps to position the various ways that we are or could think about the power of these relationships. And some of these stories are stories that communities tell about themselves, and some of them are stories that are sort of put on communities by others. So the first of these stories is about rural schools as the heart of the community. So I've worked in rural schools in five states, and I've never been to a rural community that didn't say the school is the heart of this place. And what I mean by that is the place where we gather, the place where families see one another, the place where this community comes together. But I think one of the things that I've come to appreciate is that we think about hearts in different ways, right? So in one version of a heart, the heart's a symbol. A simple symbol of love and community. And in another, a heart is a complex organ that pumps blood to the entire body. And so I would argue that what rural schools are to their communities is the latter. Because when we break it down, rural school well-being and community well-being are a complex system of interrelationships that point to the fact that in order for either to thrive, both need attention and investment. So I'll give you a second to look these over, but I'll tell you a story while you do, which is I've had calls from school board members asking, if we build a new high school in our town, is that going to revitalize us? Is that going to be the thing that drives our development as a community? And my answer to that is always like, well, what else do you have going on? You know, how are you going to leverage this new building and this new school in the context of a broader economic development plan? And I think there's been a shift here as well, that while these interrelationships have always been present, the educationalization of social services, meaning the shift of social services to the school, has implicated the school in even more areas of community well-being. And I think this is in part to capitalize on the fact that rural schools are often one of the last or only public social institutions in many rural communities. And of course, these efforts strain the system as it's currently designed. Teachers aren't trained for this, and school funding, well, we already have a strong narrative about rural school funding. And as the press to expand services increases, many communities find themselves now grappling with this other story. And that story is rural schools are a drain on public resources, a never-ending pit of inefficient need. And this story is born out of a cost efficiency narrative that haunts all of our public institutions, but is also specifically driven by how we fund public education. So a colleague of mine and a Canadian scholar of rural education once said to me, school consolidation is perhaps the only truly rural educational policy of the past century. And I think there's a lot of truth to that if we think about rurally inflected design. So one of the things that I emphasize when I talk to schools and communities about this is that what we're really talking about is competing stories about what the relationship should be between education and community. It's really, really hard to make broad claims about the potential harm or value of consolidation because there's just so many different ways to do it. But the arguments on both sides often break out this way, a sort of fiscal efficiency argument versus a community survival argument with some other points kind of thrown in there. And since these are often values-driven arguments mixed with data, the ecology is ripe for the spread or reification of misinformation. So one of the things that I try to do with communities is to bust common myths on both sides using the research that we do have, and to point out the ways that this process can doubly disadvantage certain groups, particularly poor and low-income communities. So I'm not going to take you through all of these arguments, and I'm happy to come back to this. But, you know, one of these myths is that consolidation will save money, right? This is very, very case dependent. The second is that larger schools are going to automatically yield better academic opportunities, and that can be true for some groups and not true for other groups. And then, of course, there's the two traditional rivals will never be able to merge. That's a very popular one on the community survival side. And the answer is, you know, kids are usually fine, but it's the grownups who struggle the most, right? So this brings me to the third story. I think this is one that we actually think about a lot in Maine, which is that rural schools are a catapult out of the community. The idea that rural schools encourage a cycle of brain drain that undercuts efforts to develop rural communities. And I think this is one of the inherited challenges that we face as rural educators from the evolution of the modern school system and the rural school problem. Because if we do our jobs very well in the way that federal policy imagines that we will, we are effectively encouraging youth to leave our communities to pursue post-secondary opportunities, particularly college degrees, someplace else. And we know, for the most part, that it's very hard for those students to come back. And the opportunities that they're qualified for aren't present, by and large, in many of the rural communities that they come from yet. But we'll get to that in a minute. So most of the rural educators that I know find themselves very conflicted about this, because on the one hand, broadly speaking, college degrees are a protective factor against falling into poverty over the course of your lifetime. And again, broadly speaking, about 1 in 6 Americans will be poor over the course of their lifetime. But wanting security for kids in our current system, which we probably all acknowledge has put a lot more stress on college going than on career readiness, also brings up a lot of complicated questions that are hard to answer. And these questions, I think, get to the core of our purpose as educators. Like, should we design educational experiences with the assumption that we want all kids ideally to go to college? What about the specter of student debt? What role should that play in this, especially considering that Mainers have some of the highest student loan debt in the country? How do we give students the best information about the industries that they're interested in so they understand how they've changed since their parents or grandparents worked in them and can make informed decisions about their future? How do you design an educational experience that allows for maximum flexibility and minimum value judgment on the pathways that students want to pursue? And why do we need to put pressure on rural kids to stay in or come back to rural places? This is one that I hear a lot. Don't some kids want to leave? And shouldn't that be okay? And I think these are really hard questions to answer. And some of them are questions that we have to answer with our hearts. They're not questions that can be answered through research or data, right? They're fundamentally about the kind of communities that we want to see in our state. So one of the things that I find is that I think a perspective shift can help to alleviate at least some of the stress around this. And it broadly involves thinking critically about migration patterns. So I put up this slide that shows migration patterns from the 1970s across 3 counties. So the light purple line is Washington County, the middle line is the Maine state total, and the orange line is Cumberland County, which is, you know, the more populous county to the south of us. So we've got a rural county, the Maine state average, and then an urban county. And one of the things that you can see from this, the 70s, we saw a reverse migration trend to rural areas, which is pretty atypical of the rest of the 20th century. So in a lot of ways, this represents a best case migration scenario for rural communities. So in this scenario, you can see that the most mobile demographic category is 15 to 24 year olds. They're still, even in this best case scenario, the most likely to out-migrate. But we also see an enormous influx of a very highly desirable demographic, which is the 25 to 34 year old demographic, the demographic with small children, particularly in remote rural places. So if we fast forward to the 2000s, right, we see the exacerbation of this. So here you see that 15 to 24 year olds are leaving remote rural areas in far greater numbers. That bottom one, that's the big dip, is Washington County. So here you see far fewer in-migrants from the 25 to 34 year old demographic, right? So people are not coming in to replace the young people who are leaving. And we also see the graying of Maine, right? The in-migration to rural areas, that's Washington County in the top there. of the 60 to 74-year-old demographic. So this is from the most recent data available, the 2010 data, and you can see, right, that we still have very high out-migration, but we do have much higher in-migration in the Washington County, which is the orange, right? So it's just, I put this up here as a way to think about migration patterns more broadly, because I think what we need to be thinking about isn't do our youth come back, but how are we attracting that desirable demographic between 25 and 40? And one of the things that I tell educators is that school quality is a huge driver in these decisions. So that's something that that schools can actually control. So particularly as work and its relationship to place changes, this is something that communities need to be thinking about. We need to be asking ourselves, how and why is this community that I live in a great place to raise kids? So I want to return for a moment to the dichotomy that we highlighted earlier, this pull that rural leaders feel between these two things. I think part of my job as a leader educator is to support folks in finding a way forward that feels like their goals as educators and as community members are more aligned. And I think there's a fourth story that helps to get us there. And this is the story of rural schools as a catalyst. So catalysts are agents that cause or accelerate a reaction. And I would argue that schools can be this for communities with the right leadership and values frame for their work. So I define catalytic activities as educational activities that position youth in agentic ways vis-a-vis their communities, that tackle the real present problems of those communities and support the formation of long-term partnerships between schools and communities to address these issues. So I could fill an entire talk with just examples of what I consider to be catalytic activity, but I'm just going to share one example with you. I had a student my first year at UMaine in my rural school and community leadership class, and she would drive every day from Medway, where she was a teacher, to Orono. And it gave her a lot of time to think about her work and what we were discussing around these concepts that I've just shared with you. And Medway is, like so many communities, an aging community. There's a huge amount of pressure to consolidate their middle school with the other local communities in the area. But this student had grown up there and gave me a 3-hour tour the first time I visited, which if any of you have ever been to Medway is a feat in and of itself. But she was born there and had really, really deep roots there. And there was a church, you can see it from 95, with huge historical significance to the town, but it had become a burden because it was just another aging building for them to care for. So this student, who's now the principal of that school, organized the older residents of the community, leveraging one of their assets, which was time, into teams to work with her students on a year-long local history unit to transform the church into a local historical society, which is something that the town had never had. The students, in partnership with these older residents, did research, interviews, artifact collection, they cleaned up the building, they organized the collections, and they set up the exhibits. And they were able, over the course of 2 years of this work, to give the historical society back to the town. And the students helped to run it in the summer and give tours to summer tourists and help with the governance. And this is the kind of work that I think helps reinvest communities in the power of their schools as drivers of public good, in service of the mission that Zeke was talking about earlier.
This is Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. You've been listening to a talk recorded live at UMaine's Mitchell Center in Orono. That was Associate Professor Kat Biddle on rural education. Stay with us as Interim Dean Zeke Kimball offers some closing thoughts.
So we have complex, wicked problems, and in order to solve them, we're going to have to work together. And we're going to need a highly educated citizenry to do that. And that highly educated citizenry is going to need an education that works for them. And in order for those that schooling to work in rural communities, it will have to be rurally inflected. So this brings us back to the central question that we hope to address today, which is, what exactly is a rural public good? So based on the talk that Kat and I have just given, we kind of want to make the argument that a rural public good is one that would be prohibitively difficult or impossible to provide privately. Rural public schools norm to the needs of rural communities, undiminished or enhanced by collective enjoyment, Rural schools are a profound resource for rural communities. The entire community benefits. More beneficial to the public than to individual people. Again, rural schools perpetuate rural communities. And rural by design. As Kat mentioned, there are models for schooling that totally ignore place and models of schooling that embrace place. Education as a rural public good is anchored in place. Education as a rural public good is undertaken in partnership with rural people. So it is not an educational reform movement saying to rural communities, this is how you do this. And a rural public good is done for the benefit of rural communities. So as Kat mentioned in her talk, much of the discourse about schooling in America at this point is dominated by the needs of a global economy that some benefit from enormously and others benefit from not at all. So how do we do that work in the context of a land-grant university? As a land-grant university, the University of Maine, I would argue, has a fundamental obligation to the people of Maine. And the people of Maine overwhelmingly live in rural places. As a result, when we think about education as a public good in Maine, we must also think of education as a rural good. And that means working to solve problems that matter to rural people and to rural communities. I'd now like to argue why it is that we think that the College of Education and Human Development is essential to that work. And I want to make that point rather pedantically. Where I'm standing right now, it's 563 feet to our nearest building by foot. If you drove your car, you'd have to follow the roads. It would take you 1,000 feet to get there. The next nearest research college of education is 246 miles from here, and it's located in Boston. So if we're thinking about the needs of rural schools and rural communities, I'd ask the question, are the people in this room on this campus going to help provide the solution? Or is a college of education 246 miles from here located in the city of Boston? I think the answer is fairly evident. It's part and parcel of the University of Maine's mission to serve the people and places of Maine. Maine's opportunities of tomorrow will be defined in large measure by the people listening to this talk today and others like them throughout the state. We have the expertise in the college, ranging from how to leverage educational technology to create inclusive classrooms for students with disabilities and multilingual learners, to how to help students pursue well-being in a world where that can sometimes be all too challenging. We have the expertise to think about the intersections of rural education and community development, but we can't do it alone, and we shouldn't do it alone. A key part of land-grant education has always been stewardship, an approach to partnership that connotes working with people rather than telling people what they need. Land-grant institutions are at their best when they are both expert and accessible rather than expert and elitist. We know a lot, but we do not know better. In the college, we have embedded that ethos in the way that we approach our research and engagement work. The Center for Applied Research on Education and Schools, or CARES. The CARES model emphasizes research that matters on problems that matter to the people the University of Maine was created to serve, the people of Maine. Recognizing the fundamental interconnectedness of individuals, families, schools, communities, and organizations, the CARES model reframes the standard social scientific tradition of conducting research on people towards a model that is focused on engaging with people to emphasize real-world solutions to real-world problems. Although that remains a work in progress for us, we believe that it is only through partnership that we can hope to leverage educational systems to improve lives, schools, organizations, and communities. Well, that's a role that we're really proud to play. It's one that we recognize we shouldn't play alone. Looking toward the future, Maine faces many wicked problems that will require innovative human-centered solutions. Without such a response, climate change, an aging workforce, housing shortages, widening geographic opportunity divides, growing economic inequality, and other pressing challenges, they're too daunting. They threaten the state's long-term economic prosperity, and more importantly, the future of Mainers. We believe that and have focused our research and engagement work on the premise that education-informed and linked to rural community development will be an essential strategy for creating the adaptive, rural-inflected strategies needed to provide the sustainability solutions of tomorrow. Thank you.
That was Zeke Kimball from UMaine, discussing the complicated challenges and opportunities facing rural communities and the schools that serve them. You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public. We'll end today's program with a few brief questions and answers from the November 25th event hosted by the Mitchell Center at UMaine in Orono.
This is Linda Silke. I grew up in Iowa. My parents went to the smallest school in the state of Iowa in a little town called Diagonal. And every one of the people that I know in Iowa should hear what you're doing and how you are thinking about these things. So do you see steps that all of us who are here today listening to this talk that we could start to take? We may not have the great knowledge that you have. We may work in other areas like sustainability or other things. How do we come together? Do the two of you have suggestions for how we could make that happen?
I'll start and hopefully buy Kat some time to come up with a better answer. So the way that I would think about this, and I didn't do a perfect job making this case when I was, you know, rambling about the Hatch Act and the Smith-Lever Act, is that early on in the DNA of land-grant universities, there's the idea that people ought to be able to bring a problem to the university, and the university ought to be able to solve it. At the University of Maine, we do still do that on occasion, right? You can pick up the phone and you can call someone over in cooperative extension and you can say, well, I've got this weird 6-foot-tall plant that's kind of scaring me and my pets. What is it? Please help. Or I can bring a tick and I think it's like $10 into the tick lab and say, please test this, right? So those are ways that the university doesn't bring its solutions to people. People bring their problems to the university and the university becomes a partner in the solutions. But along the way, land-grant universities became research universities, and research universities started to focus on the production and dissemination of knowledge. And one of the things that Kat and I have been grappling with is whether you can do that while also being responsive. And we feel really clearly that you can. So one of the first things that we did when we started to articulate the CARES model is we asked people to tell us what their problems were, right? And then we started to ask, well, how can we fit those into our agenda? That's always been part and parcel of the way that educational scholars do their work. But it's not often been the systematic ethos of an entire group of educational scholars. And the reality is that we know more collectively than we know individually. And so beginning to flip that frame and really allow the problems to come to us and to adapt the solutions needed to the problems rather than to bring the solutions to the community and say, please be grateful for this wonderful wisdom that we have bestowed upon you. Doesn't seem like it should be a fundamental reframe in land-grant education, but oftentimes it is. And so that's the first step that I think we've taken in our work. And I wonder, Kat, if you would want to add more.
Well, I guess the only thing that I would add is just a different sphere of participation as a citizen, which is that education is locally governed, right? And so we all have the opportunity to go to our school board meetings, to be involved in the decisions that are getting made about our school, about our schools and our school districts. And I think that's one potential area if you find any of this compelling in terms of action in your home community. The other piece, though, I would say is thinking about going back to that question of how is this a great place to raise kids? I think a great place to raise kids is a place where kids have agency, right? And so thinking about, you know, one of the One of the most striking statistics that I find is from the name of the data set is escaping me, but it's the Youth Behavioral Health Survey, effectively. And it talks about only 50% of kids feeling like they matter in their communities. And that's something that we can all take action around, right? You know, is helping to cultivate a sense of belonging, saying hi to young people, cultivating opportunities for young people to participate in governance, you know, the things that support civic engagement, that support belonging. But that what that means is embracing an agentic view of young people, even as young as elementary school.
Thank you. Yeah, very, very interesting. Another point that you all made was very interesting. You were talking about strategies for addressing problems. And two things you mentioned are hope and convergent science. Can you tell us a little bit more about that interesting idea?
So traditionally, the way that we organize knowledge in academia is based upon our discrete fields, right? I do work in education, so my work in educational history has nothing to do with the work that historians do in history. That makes very little sense in practice. And when you're actually trying to solve problems that matter, for example, when you're trying to create sustainability solutions, disciplinary silos become a major problem really quickly. Because the reality is most of the problems that we have in the world are complicated enough that if we were to try to address them within the context of a single discipline, we'd be unlikely to do that terribly well. And we'd certainly do that in a far less time efficient manner. And the reality is many of the problems that we want to confront and we want to develop sustainability solutions in response to are absolutely time imperative. And so convergent science looks at the ways that we can bring in insights from multiple different disciplines and use those in combination with one another to create knowledge that couldn't have existed within the confines of a single academic discipline. And then leverage those in the service of problems. And so interdisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity, these are all approaches that break down disciplinary silos and use them, use the resultant knowledge in new ways. As far as hope goes, this is actually Kat's field more than mine, but I'll start the answer. The reality is that a lot of the problems that we have are the problems that we had 50 years ago and 100 years ago in educational circles. So as Kat mentioned, the discourse around rural education and around rural schools has not changed in 100 years. And what that means is that in the context of our careers, we can hope to solve the problems that our predecessors who were no less smart or talented or committed than we are sought to solve, or we can confront the reality that they were confronting wicked problems. And sometimes wicked problems are intractable, but it makes it no less important that we confront them head on. And the only way that we can do that and keep going for 10, 20, 30, 40 years that it might take us to actually make meaningful progress is hope. So hope is a fundamentally radical act in the face of a challenging world, but it's absolutely essential if we're going to confront the sorts of really complex problems that demand convergent science of us.
Go ahead. Well, I just want to say, first of all, I'm Mar from chemistry. I'm just really excited to see this articulation of the work you're doing. I remember being so frustrated about 15 years ago at a panel of all kinds of community outreach folks. And as a member of the research Center for Research in STEM Education, I was thinking, why are there no education people here? Isn't that where so much of our outreach happens, just organically? So thank you. So I think the kind of work we've done with the rural middle schools, for example, is, you know, fits in with what you're talking about. I'm very excited to see this. So not really a question, just thank you.
Well, and I'll say thank you in response. And it gives me an opportunity to underline something that I hope was clear, which is there have always been, and even apart from the work that Kat and I are doing to articulate the CARES model in the college, there would be people at the University of Maine doing this work. So our reframing is really about turning an entire college in that direction and leveraging the collective capacity of the people within it. It certainly isn't to say that that work has not been happening and wouldn't happen without us. It absolutely has been, and it absolutely would. We're just eager to work in partnership with folks like you and with local communities and to do what we can to leverage the resources that we have in order to improve the conditions in rural communities and rural schools.
Yeah, I mean, in some way, I think the schools here in Maine and elsewhere have been such a resource that they've been taken for granted in the same way that the streams and the fields and the forests have been.
Can I ask one more question? Who should know about your important research? If all of us put our things together and we went to the governor and said to the governor, you need to sit down with these two people because this is important to our future, would that be a good thing?
You know, I think the reality is that education is embedded in systems. And it's one of the reasons that the problems that we confront are so complex. The reality is that what happens in a local community is embedded in a larger regional community, is embedded in the state, is embedded in the country, is embedded in the global discourses related to education. And that all of these things bump up against other complex systems. I don't think there's a right or a wrong place to start with something as complicated as that. So I think the answer is you just start. And so if you're sitting down with the governor and having this conversation, by all means. But if you're sitting down with a member of a local school board or a teacher or a parent in a rural community, like those are all equally meaningful ways of starting. Because when a problem is deeply embedded in complex systems and the connections amongst and between the levels of the system and the parts of the system are so entangled that you really can't even begin to map it, you just start. And there's no right or wrong place to do that.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk titled Education as a Rural Public Good by UMaine's Interim Dean Zeke Kimball and Associate Professor Kat Biddle. It was recorded in Orono on November 25th, 2024. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by Brenna Farrell, with help from me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.